Accession number 10403, Reel 18.
Mr. Harold Sell, Reel 18. How did you come to leave Moosburg then?
It so happened that one day we were talking to the French, and the French became very excited and said that they had been reading all the orders and instructions which had come into the Oberkommandantur in the German office, and that we were going to be moved to Maurice Trubau, which was up in Moravia. And therefore, as the Gestapo would be coming in to search and supervise our move, we must return to the French all our clandestine equipment. So we returned all our equipment which we had, including a radio set thing which we took back. Then we were given a photograph of the place we were going to. And we were given a complete rundown of what was going to happen. In fact, their intelligence must have been excellent, because they did tell me that on a certain floor, in a certain place, at a recess in the window, there would be a part of a radio waiting. So it was quite obvious that the network of the French organization, or the international organization, or whatever it was pretty widespread. So we carried out all these instructions, and then without any warning, they rushed in one morning, dogs, everything, bugles, dogs, armed guards, chased everybody out into a field nearby, put barbed wire around us, portable barbed wire fences, gangs of these unpleasant gentlemen from the Gestapo came in and started to search everybody. It was a pretty higgledy-piggledy affair, because we found out that the way to defeat all these characters was we could create as much chaos as possible, jumble up all clothing, and then pass equipment and stuff from hand to hand after they'd been searched, and hide it in the piles of stuff and sort it out later. These Gestapo were chaps who had been recruited locally, and they were dressed in the national costume, that was to say, the sort of Bavarian affair, with their tweed suits and their trilby hats with a feather in the side, their telltale little gold swastika in their hip pocket, and in their lapel, and in their hip pocket they had a huge bulge where they carried a Luger. And all together they were a pretty unpleasant group of people. And at that stage we didn't increase our popularity, because one of our chaps must have been a pretty good pickpocket in civil life, because he relieved one of these chaps of a Luger, and this caused a bit of consternation. The fellow didn't know he'd lost it, and when we were finally moved off to the train, this fellow walked out to the commander of this guest band, said, handed him the Luger back and said one of his men had lost it. Well, of course, the fellow got it. He went to our pop society popularity, because one of our... Well, they were then moved into trains, and it was the usual stuff of handcuffs. The fellow lost it. And when finally put in these cattle trucks, and then we went trundling on and on, night and day, over the Danube at night, through Chemnitz. I remember going through it, and had to go back, and he looked on back and smelled one of his that had lost, of course, the German army going up to the Eastern Front. And at every stop we made, we just took a note. They were moved into trains, and it was in the the usual, so that we could in due course incorporate it into a document for going back as to what troops and units were going up to the Eastern Front. It was then virtually getting on for almost the depths of Russian winter. And the middle on this was then getting towards Poland. It was very, very cold, and we weren't really equipped for it. We would stop periodically and have some soup, which was made, partake of the soup, but was for the German troops as well, because we were going up with the German trains. And we got quite a lot of information there. It was pretty obvious that the Germans were ill-equipped for a Russian winter. They themselves had got underclothing, which I think they had looted from the local inhabitants. Their uniforms were not padded uniforms, nothing that you would expect them to have to face a campaign like that. And I suppose ultimately that led to their downfall. However, up we went on this caper, and we got through Dresden and up through Breslau, and then into the Protectorate, as they called it then, and then into this mountainous, foresty area, and we came to this camp, Barisch Trubau, which in fact was a huge building, which might well have been barracks. They looked as though they were barracks. They were probably one, two, they had three floors, huge buildings, corridors, and assembly areas. And that, of course, had been well cordoned off and with the usual guard facilities, dogs, a commandant. And there we came under our own organisations. We came together, really, as a team.
Was this just officers?
Now, at that stage, we were all being sorted out, and this was made for officers only.
And about how many of you were there?
Might have been about 800 or 900. And, of course, as you can imagine, with a group of officers like that, we had some pretty brilliant people, and they were able to develop all sorts of things. We hadn't anything. We hadn't any clothing. We'd had no Red Cross parcels. We'd had nothing since Italy. And we're not in what you might call in the best shape. However, we were in good heart. Morale was high. And there we formed the camp properly on the basis of what we had learned in Moosburg and on the basis of what experiences we had with the French, or what I'd had with the French, and how to handle these things. We were then their duties were ostensibly to look after and clean all the cleaning of the camp. And I had the job. I took the job as, you might say, company commander of the orderlies, as they were, of these British other ranks, known to the Germans as the Ordnanzenführer. We braced into companies. We had our cloak and dagger department. We had our administration. We had our SPO. We broke up into library sections, scientific sections, radio sections, university sections, drawing sections, theatre nations.
Which ones were you most interested in?
Well, I was mostly interested in. After my meeting with the Germans, until I'd met what I call the second line German troops in northern Italy, I'd been in contact with the German first line troops. And the German first line troops, I'd formed a high opinion of them, although I hated their guts. The point was they were professionally good and professionally correct and under good discipline. That, of course, completely reversed when you got to the second line units, who were formed principally from people who'd been through the party structure. And their treatment of the inhabitants was so awful that I came to the conclusion that the German race as a whole should be exterminated. because nobody could treat anybody the way they did. And subsequently, their treatment of foreign nationals and people in Germany that I found later was did nothing to dispel that.
Were you aware of the concentration camps then?
Not at that time. I came later. However, there we were. We formed into our things like this, and I therefore opted to take over the Ordnanzenführer job, as I saw it as a means of being able to get close, near to the German, as it were, because of the administration, and to use the British other rank for information getting, and also I was then a dedicated anything to cause the harm to the Boche. We then were joined by David Stirling, who you probably heard of, who was the SAS founder.
What kind of a man was he?
David Stirling was tall, a thin fellow, a proper catch-em-alive old type of boy who was game for anything, would take on the Germans at their old game, was a thorn in the flesh to them all the time, and was always organizing means of discomfiture. He would always be behind organizing the tunnels and anything to harm
What were these means of
discomfiture? You mean discomfiture to the German? Well, the Germans themselves were under very strict control by their own headquarters, and their discipline code was very strict and was often mismanaged to their own nationals by their own officers, who were not always of the best type. And if you wanted to discomfort them, one way you could discomfort them, you would say, well, now, we've got the cause and the maximum disruption. What do they fear most at this time? Now, at one time, I remember, they feared typhus, because there was typhus rampant amongst the Russians not far away, and they were dying in their thousands. There'd been mass graves. And the system they had was that anybody within an area was completely cordoned off. They were virtually abandoned. The whole of the population was put under a standstill order. Everybody's clothing was taken away and disinfested. Everybody was examined. And really, they had to import extra troops in the area in order to put a blanket control over the area. The typhus to the German was a frightening thing. So a suitable candidate would be found, a suitable flea would be found, and you would catch a flea or two, and louse was a thing that we used to catch, put them in a matchbox, in a box, and then the candidate would ask for permission to see the doctor. He would run around the compound half a dozen times and get up a sweat and be blue in the face, his pulse rating. And he'd scratch his chest and cause blood to flow in various parts, scratches on his body. He would then time it and get into the time the doctor to see him, and then he would stand to attention, and he would bare his chest in front of the doctor, produce the matchbox and say, Herr Doctor, ich habe ein Kleberlaus. And the sight of a louse and the scratched chest and the man sweating, puffing like mad, is pulsing into what... It just depends.
Things you do to discomfort them.
Well, in the various... You see, we used to have tunnels. We used to dig a lot of tunnels.
Were these actual escape tunnels?
Escape tunnels and other types of tunnels. We used to dig dummy tunnels. You would dig a tunnel, and of course sometimes you used to make a mess of them, because you had the equipment. And at Maurice Trubau, we dug on the chest, sweating, and puffing like his head, and what that the best camouflage for the tunnel because the Germans had anti-tunnel devices going around a lot, and they used to send squads of men called tunnel tappers who put prods down. And they dug the tunnel, and they decided that they would dig the tunnel under the commandant's house. That would be the best way, which was just on the side. They would dig the tunnel and come out in his back garden. They thought that was as good as any. However, they made a mess of the calculations. And the dining room fell in one night. And the commandant's table came into the tunnel. That caused a bit of a flap. And we went through the motions of a hate all the way through there for several months. Several days. And
what was a hate?
Well, a hate would be turned out for these roll calls at infrequent time, kept standing for hours and hours and hours. They would take everything away from you. They would take away all your knives, forks and spoons. They would take away all your bread crust parcels and destroy them. They would take some clothing away. They would any petty little thing to cause you discomfort. And you just had to, you knew what these hates were, you knew they were coming off, and you organized yourselves to defeat them.
How would you do that?
Well, you would have things about your person, bits of string, bits of tin, and so on and so forth, so that when you were outside, you could do something about it. You see, the thing, your hands used to get very cold, you hadn't any gloves, you hadn't anything like that. So what we used to do in those circumstances, we used to make what was the equivalent in England of what you would call a nightlight. That is, you'd make a very little tin, and you would fill it, you would save bits of fat, or you would save a bit of the German boot polish or fat, and put a bit of string in for a wick. And then you would put that in a bigger tin with holes on the outside. And then when you went out on these awful long stands, you would then light this thing. It wouldn't be seen from outside, and you could put it inside your tunic, and that would diffuse a bit of heat. There were thousands of tricks we used to do. When the commandants got particularly bad, I remember they ground up a lot of old razor blades and put it in the pig swill. And that flattened all the pigs of the German garrison. It was reprisal and counter-reprisal the whole time.
Were there any tunnels that were successful or seriously intended to
work? Yes, so there were two. We had an operation, I think we called Wembley, I'm not certain. But the idea was we to get a party in army and commandant got David Sterling was the organiser, and they got some out through a tunnel successfully, not many, and then they went out dressed as Russians, because there was a lot of Russians in the area, and they got away. They were all properly briefed, and the whole of the camp turned to. Everybody, as I explained, you can imagine the organisation didn't require one man. Everybody in the camp were the ears and eyes, and every night, whatever you saw, your watchers, you had permanent watchers, watching every move of every German, and it came into the intelligence section and into the cloak and dagger department. And from there, the thing diffused. So we had one chap who got out, but he was caught. He dug the tunnel. The idea was, outside the camp perimeter, we had air raid shelters. They were slit trenches. And the idea was that we would rush out into the trenches during an air raid and lie down. Well, what this chap did, he rushed out there, and we'd made a tube out of a gas cape. And when we were out there, we gathered in, and we filled with the spoil in outside over the top of him, leaving this tube into his mouth below. And the idea was he'd remain there till night, then break up and get out. However, the German dogs were going around on the whole of the perimeter to see if there were any more. It was a schoolboy, so. But that was the thing.
The cross, yes. Parcels. At Marish Trubelau.
Get Red Cross parcels. That was once all packed, tins of margarine, a tin of some very And we balanced it out. Yes, because we got better food and because we were there. We're on them.
What diet were you on there then?
But we had about a loaf of Turkish brown rye bread per week, a loaf and a half at that stage. And that was very sustaining.
How did you get on with your fellow prisoners? It's rather a tense situation, I suppose. Were you able to... Was there any tension in the air, or did people get fed up of living in cramped circumstances with each other?
Well, people... You see, you formed yourself into various groups. You see, you found people who were interested in the theatre were all band together, and they would have a common interest. Those that were doing studying or doing something would have a common interest. Those who were making and using band instruments had a common interest. You found that the camp broke down naturally into groups. You did, of course, find those who did not fit into any group, who were maladjusted or had got off their rockers a bit, and sometimes they had to be put into the hospital if it got beyond them. There's quite a number. It did get beyond them.
What symptoms would this?
And I always found that these chaps who went that way had not been in a line regiment group. They had not been under discipline. They had not been there. They were in rather the services, like the RASC or some other unit. And they were not attuned to sort of mental as well as physical hardship. And it seemed to affect them more. One chap went off his rockers. And I don't know who he thought he was, but he would dress in a sheet, and he'd walk up to the wire, to the sentries, and he'd almost deliver a sermon and sing various psalms and hymns, and then he'd go into a terrible tirade about God knows what. And we came to a fairly amicable arrangement with the German commandant, whereby we would not give an undertaking that we would not escape. We would never get parole. However, when a fellow got sick like that, we used to go to the German commandant and say, "Now look here, notwithstanding, this man, as you agree, requires medical treatment. You can't give it to him or won't give it to him. Now, we will give you our word that this man will not do anything that is subversive. What he does will be entirely spontaneous because he's mentally deranged, we think." And in most cases, the Germans accepted that, and they gave orders to their sentries that if these chaps, and they were shown, you know, they were paraded and said, "These are the blokes," approached them, the sentries didn't fire. They called for assistance and they rushed in and they grabbed him and flung him out.
Which groups did you attach yourself? What were your interest groups?
Well, I attached myself, as I tell you, to the information gathering and to the controlling and looking after the interests of the British other ranks and getting information. And then that was...
What about the sort of recreational groups you mentioned? Well, or was that your recreation?
That was had to be my recreation as well. That was full time because it was a fairly exacting one. I'd have an odd game of whatever it was, rounders or...
But you didn't take part in any...
I didn't take part in theatricals or anything. I did a bit in the forgeries department. I did a bit in the, because I was an engineer, and I did a bit in the key making business. I perfected my skill as a locksmith. That was pretty full time.
Did the theatricals put on any shows for the prisoners?
Oh yes, they always used to put on shows. They had score centres.
I
played various things like Iolanthe and...
What standard was it?
It was quite high, really, the musician side. Of course, we had several professional musicians there. We had a chap called Samson who played the trumpet, who I believe was a well-known trumpet player later after the war. And he was good, and they used to give recitals. But you see, these chaps were also there for a purpose. That department would make all the clothing for escapees and all this business.
What, the theatrical?
Yes. Theatrical people.
Was there ever any chance of you being allowed to escape? I mean, being put on the rota for escape, or were you too valuable in the camp?
Well, it was made clear to me that what my job was. It was made clear to me that I had to see that the security of the radios, the security of information, the security of the other ranks, who were the main link between us and the outside world, and that was it. And the system was that we were in, you might say, cells, that we never ever were told what was the other section was doing, and we never inquired what the other section was doing, because if one of us was picked up, the interrogation would have been detrimental to the rest of the enterprise.
So you wouldn't know exactly what the forgeries, well, some of the departments other than your own infant were doing?
Not necessarily, not in detail. We wouldn't know, for example, where they wouldn't tell me which particular part of the camp that they had hidden any particular thing. All I would be told would be that through the British other ranks, I had to make certain early warning was given that if any indication was being made that the Germans were investigating certain areas. And that's what I'd do.
Were you ever interrogated about, picked up?
You mean in Maurice Trubau? No, I was never interrogated. You see, I was in virtually, I won't say in constant contact, but quite close contact with the Lagerhauptmann, who was the man in charge of the Lager, and he used to supervise, he used to see that the other ranks did all their work, and he had to give orders to the other ranks through me.
How did the other ranks react to having to do this sort of cleaning work for the Germans?
Well, the other ranks, of course, reacted quite well, because they realised that they were there for a higher purpose than just putting the commandant's new blotting paper in. And if anybody happened to be there or anything was there, well, it was they were most astute in making certain that the commandant never had a paper left in his waste paper. The other did all the rank work and all their stuff, and he had us to give orders through the other rank. Go into his office, take all these papers out and copies of cartons or whatever that may be going. The other put them in the pocket and then take the papers they'd brought in to the incinerator. This was the cover.